Welcome to the 64th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series, entitled Restoration as Event and Idea, Art in Europe, 1814 to 1820, art historian Thomas Crowe will consider the period following the fall of Napoleon. During this time, artists throughout Europe were left uncertain and adrift, with old certainties and boundaries dissolved. How did they then set new courses for themselves? Professor Crowe's lectures answer that question by offering both the wide view of art centers across the continent, Rome, Paris, London, Madrid, Brussels, and a close-up focus on individual actors, Francisco Goya, Jacques-Louis David, Antonio Canova, Sir Thomas Lawrence, Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres, and Théodore Géricault. Whether directly or indirectly, these artists were linked in a new international network with changed artistic priorities and new creative possibilities emerging from the wreckage of the old. In this fifth lecture, entitled The Laboratory of Brussels, 1816 to 1819, The Apprentice Navez and the Master David Redraw the Language of Art, originally delivered at the National Gallery of Art on April 19, 2015, Professor Crowe demonstrates how the exiled David seized the medium of drawing to foster new ways of selecting and reorganizing fragments of a discarded past.
Before I start in earnest, I wanted to give thanks to friends and colleagues at the Kimball Museum of Art in Fort Worth, where the central painting in the latter part of this talk lives. Eric Lee, George Shackelford, and Nancy Edwards have been wonderful in their hospitality and assistance in working on the whole area of Late David to which this talk is devoted, but not just David. For there was one young artist in the master's studio for whom the departure of David into Belgian exile was no exile for him. And I should have said that I can't remember whether I described him as French, because he had been French, but then ex-French. This is François-Joseph Navez, sometimes pronounced Navet. And you see him in a self-portrait of this moment. He had been born in the fortress town of Charleroi and had been French only by virtue of Napoleon's annexation of present-day Belgium into France. With the creation of the United Kingdom of the Netherlands, Navez abruptly gained a new nationality and lost a number of prerogatives that he had enjoyed by virtue of French nationality, one of them being his standing for the Rome Prize competition of 1816, the one which you'll remember that Géricault, among others, was just about to enter. He returned to settle in Brussels during January 1816, just days before David and his wife arrived to set up house there. In September of the following year, of 1817, during the weeks just preceding his departure for Rome on a private Belgian scholarship in place of the official French support he had had to forego, Navez painted three versions of David's portrait, this being the second and the strongest. It would be difficult to say that the sitter looks all of his 69 years, despite the adroit gray highlights brushed into the honey brown coiffure. No prominent lines interrupt the smooth passages of flesh. And Navez has also taken care to mitigate, if not disguise in shadow, the protruding growth on David's left cheek. The viewer's attention diverted by the flourishes of white that establish the wing of this immaculate collar on the opposite side. The ribbon of the Napoleonic Legion of Honor appears all more defiantly striking in its artful profile. While Navez signals his fealty with the Latin abbreviation for Discopolis, disciple, under his signature. The polished composure of Navez's portrait of David argues for the older artist's formidable capacities in the present and his adaptability to his new and supportive surroundings. The period in Brussels during which David and Navez worked together amounted to about 18 months. But from that limited span of time, the younger artist, then about approaching 30 years of age, produced two further works of lasting significance. Wait a minute, I should have said three. Because the first, on which we will spend a little less time, is this accomplished group portrait of his friend and patron, the professor of pharmacology and chemical entrepreneur, Auguste Donat de Hompine, in the company of his young family. The performance is suavely confident, with a command of detail in a self-consciously Flemish manner, the attention given to the pattern of the carpet, as well as the scumbled light highlights on the sleeve of Madame de Hompine, enlivening an arresting disposition of the larger forms, which are chained to one another as if suspended from the light grip of their daughter on her father's hand. The high technical quality and softened sympathy of Navez's portrait of the Hompine family links David to their world. That is, to a world pacified and open to scientific progress, commercial expansion, and general improvement. Hompine, among other accomplishments, pioneered the concept of steam heat. But none of that prepares us for a work of Navez from 1816 like this one. He executed this presentation drawing on the subject of the lamentation over the body of Christ as another commission from Hompine, presumably intended for domestic devotion. It had remained in the family and largely unseen until only a few years ago when it entered the collection of the Louvre. Nothing in Navez's, competent but unremarkable previous work anticipates the radical syntax of this picture. It's finished in black and ochre and white chalk to nearly the highest possible refinement in tonal modeling. The contained white highlights at the forehead and throat of the Virgin scintillate with luminosity where no halo or other supernatural sign of divinity enters the picture. The effect plays against what you are probably taking, and almost anyone would take in reproduction, as the buff color of the paper, just as we early observed Gros using his buff-colored paper to such atmospheric effect in his drawing of the burning of Moscow. But this apparently lighter ground is in fact the top layer of the work, not its foundation. An opaque cladding of light ochre chalk laid over the black underneath. The entire surface is built up more like a painting to an extraordinarily thick and uniform degree across every square centimeter of its surface. And it's enormous. That is strikingly large for any work on paper approaching 4 feet in height. By compacting all the extension of the bodies, indeed virtually all of the space out of the scene, Navez transforms inherited expectations for narrative painting. Gone are meaningful liaisons and directed gazes present in the close prototype, with which Navez would have been intimately familiar. The central panel of the Michielsen altarpiece by Peter Paul Rubens in Antwerp Cathedral, nicknamed Christ on the Straw. Now, as Lamentations go, Rubens's conception is quite economical and spare, but it does not anticipate the airless compression and sacrifice of legible narrative performed by Navez. The young Davidian essentially takes the top part of Rubens's composition and stretches it to fill the entire upright format, even at the cost of pushing the body of Christ almost out of view. The only connections between the actors now lie in their forced physical proximity, their visible bodies never more than partially seen, their gazes and attitudes swiveling without regard for one another. The extent of the fragmentation is such that the presumed hand of the older male at the top, dead center, is so separate from the figure's invisible body that it could conceivably belong to someone else reaching around the wall of the tomb. The left nipple of Christ, which is an unelevating detail of flesh, assumes outsized importance as it punctuates the bottom center symmetrically of the whole axis of the composition. But it is not as if Navez has abandoned compositional order for sheer accumulation of figural moments. The interlace of forms is almost elegant in its play of linkage and correspondence, but the expected devotional contemplation of Christ's body is hardly possible, as it seems already to be sinking out of view into limbo. The concentrated emotion in each head invites separate consideration, and centrality is taken over by the thousand-yard stare of the Virgin at the center, whose gaze past the viewer focuses on an unknown earthly vision rather than upward toward celestial consolation as it had in Rubens's altarpiece. But what is she meant to be seeing? There's a pendant work by Navez, I think, that offers a possible answer. In 1817, Navez produced this finely wrought oil on canvas, no larger, in fact, than the paper Lamentation, and also for his friend and patron, Alptine. Its subject is Saint Veronica of Milan with her parents, so it is a kind of family portrait, too. The saint holding the crown of thorns, still dripping with fresh blood, puts one instantly in mind of Veronica of the Veil on the road to Calvary. But this is not she. This Veronica lived in the late 15th century in a village near Milan, withdrawn and obsessively devoted to punishingly menial tasks, she experienced a vision of the Virgin who instructed her never to cease contemplating the passion of Christ. The young woman was seen to obey this injunction to the point of ceasing all human communication as she envisioned the suffering Christ in her own hallucinatory reality. In Navez's painting, the saint's gaze is directed toward the viewer rather than beyond him or her, the viewer becoming thus implicated in the perpetual moment of death, its redemption in the balance. Now, the same model appears to have served Navez for both his Virgin and his Veronica. The drawing of the Lamentation revealing to us what the stare of the saint apprehends. The Saint Veronica shares the anomic logic of the drawing, likewise emphasizing the isolation of each bust-length personage from the others, squeezing in from the sides so that no setting is palpable, rendering the expressions of the parents deeply ambiguous. Is it vicarious identification with their daughter's harrowing mental participation in Christ's sacrifice, that is, sharing in her piety? Or is it despair at their loss of a child? To what appears to have been some severe autistic or depressive mental condition, which the institution of the church was able to transfigure into a beatific state. Did Navez and his friend Omptin, the medical professor, perceive this too? The artist's choices of media, along with the chronological proximity of the two works, suggest to me that they did. The unreality of the drawing, both its heightened vividness combined with a breakdown in normal human syntax, finds a form for disordered hallucinatory vision. By the same logic, drops of blood find their way onto the lap of the saint, either Christ's or her own, as she is said to have received the endlessly painful wounds of the crown of thorns herself, soon to be joined by stigmata in her palms. Beyond the particular case of the other Saint Veronica, the pair of works by the young Navez reckon with some general loss of confidence in shared meanings, previously guiding ideologies and ruins around them. Their imagination of sainthood, Navez and Omptin, reverts to a degree zero of additive detachable motifs, akin to the collapse of communicative syntax in a disordered mind, and personified as possibly the most abjectly alienated of possible Christian subjects. But a compensatory sympathy with her plight and with alienated souls in general rescues the work from clinical detachment or aesthetic negation. And I'm far from likening Navez and Omptin to some present-day neuroscientist popping up to explain, that is, explain away, a visionary work of art by somatic causes. The suffering of the unfortunate Veronica, however founded in earthly pathology it might have been, becomes altogether different if the suffering of Christ makes all the difference to your sense of the world. In the rendering of Navez, her sainthood does not place her in another world. That condition remains fully a part of this unredeemed one, the one that we all inhabit. By forging this drastically new pictorial logic, how much, we can ask, was Navez collaborating with David? The pattern of their interaction in these years, the disciple inscription on the David portrait, suggests that it would have been close. But signs of David's part in the conversation mostly post-date the departure of Navez for his extended Roman sojourn, which took place in the fall of 1817. One of the small number of David's drawings dated to 1817, however, follows the logic of his pupil's lamentation in Saint Veronica. Many of you will recognize the source of this drawing, David's own monumental canvas, Leonidas at Thermopylae, a work he had struggled with from 1801 to its belated completion in 1814, just as the French Empire collapsed. Tales from the studio tell us of indecision, whole segments of the painting removed and replaced, a swarm of studio apprentices doing much of the later work. David was in no position to transport this huge work to Brussels, but one wonders whether he would have wanted to, or whether he could have faced working again on its frustratingly immense scale. He cannot leave the themes of the painting behind as he recapitulates the subject on this sheet 3 years later as a constellation of essential bust-length motifs, the setting eliminated, and spatial cues of only the most minimal kind remaining. Large-scale painting left at home, the core symbolic vocabulary of that painting retained, repeated, and reconfigured. This drastic filtering done from memory casts the story of the steadfast Spartan 300, killed to a man, stopping the Persians at Thermopylae Pass, into a handful of fragments. The resigned gaze of the commander, the homosexual farewell between the bearded veteran and his swooning Ephebe, the ambivalent witnessing of the dark helot slave and the skyward gesturing priest. No more, no less. So would we be right to think of this as a symptom of his isolation and reduced circumstances? Or, as I think is the case, would David be turning his back on a cumbersome, overweight rhetoric in favor of something more nimble, something more improvisatory, a mode of art that he could command under his sole authorship? And you can see that this drawing is signed with a flourish, marked with place and date. Now, the original Leonidas canvas had been meant to serve as a companion to David's intervention of the Sabine women, exhibited in 1799. And sometime in his second year of exile, 1818, David distilled that painting into an even more reduced summation on paper. A bare trio of Hersilia at the center, the Sabine wife of Romulus as the pacifying force between her Roman husband on the right and the Sabine champion Tatius at the left. And then there follows, in David's output, once these plainly derivative drawings were out of the way, a remarkable production of works in black chalk on paper, congruent with these exercises in revision and recollection. They include intractably enigmatic combinations of dramatic figures in ancient or other historical costume. Caprice that come into my head, as David described them in a letter to another devoted Belgian pupil. This sheet from 1819 exemplifies the meaning of caprice, I think, as sudden change or turn of mind without apparent or adequate motive. That's the phrase from the Oxford English Dictionary. And the French counterpart, Le Grand Robert, offers the equivalent, arbitrary determination. The intricately intertwined scarves and wraps keep this trio of female faces in continually restless circulation. Their expressive countenances, each emphatic but ambiguous in its emotional charge, together exemplify fugitive states of mind as fully as art can probably accomplish. And David accumulated scores of these, almost none of them intended as studies for a painted work. In the same letter where he uses the term caprice, he reveals that he didn't intend to keep these drawings tucked away in an album or portfolio, but instead wanted to frame them in 8 groupings of 4 drawings each, as I've imagined some such combinations here. As each vignette on a single sheet distills some discrete complex of emotion, either among the members of some compact group or within a conflicted single individual, these matrices of drawings would have organized the basic data of narrative painting into abstract grids, as if to array all of these sketched possibilities as a simultaneous matrix of combinations, rather than pantomimes of fictional events. The overall size of the array would be capable of competing with the wall-holding capacity of a painting, while the large, heavy passages of black crayon would have communicated over the requisite distance that a painting would demand. From 1815, David and Navez appear deliberately to have begun building not only a new foundation of combinable elements, but also new unconventional principles governing their selection and their organization. And for David especially, this meant a newly intensive immersion into dramatic poetry. The house in which he settled with his wife, as we noted in the third lecture, lay in the street directly behind the principal theater of the city, the Théâtre de la Monnaie, the equivalent in Brussels to the Parisian Comédie Française. The present-day stage door of the theater is under that arcade at the left. In their first years in Brussels, they endured the construction of a new, more elaborate and commodious theater than the one that was demolished in 1818 to create the open square that exists to this day in front of this freestanding classical building. And the arrow once again indicates David's house in relation to the new footprint and public space. On the testimony of his family and friends, David could be seen in his regular chair at every performance in both the old theater and the one that replaced it. Classical tragedy and lyric opera on the stage made for a nightly escape from his urban dwelling into a different world, one simpler but deeper in its outlines than the messy complexities of contemporary life outside. And on those evenings when the theater was dark, once a week, his son informs us, quote, he would sit after dinner at home in the large room that served as his salon and dining room, overlooked by his copies of Napoleon Crossing the St. Bernard Pass and the portrait of Napoleon in his study. He would conceive and execute drawings in black crayon. This sheet of 1819 edges close to known tragic scenarios. The unconscious or dead young males might call to mind the brothers of Antigone, daughter of Oedipus, for whom the frontally staring maiden, eyes glistening and delicately nuanced countenance, could easily stand. But that analogy is proffered and just as quickly withdrawn. Both of the young males wear honorific laurels, but only one of Antigone's male siblings is honored in the play, while the other dies disgraced. So the question becomes, could the experiments of the drawings be translated into the settled format of oil on canvas? That medium carrying an ingrained expectation of narrative specifics. David's Anger of Achilles was only the third historical subject he had undertaken since his exile 3 years before. You see it here in its restored frame, which the staff at its current home, the Kimball Museum, in Fort Worth believe, that this is the frame in which it was first exhibited. And its form, I think, supports that conviction, the simplicity of this surround, conveying both empire-style elegance and archaic splendor simultaneously. The logic of the scene so contained preserves key traits of the caprice on which David spent his non-theatrical evenings. But it bears a clear title and known characters of myth and literature: Achilles, Clytemnestra, her husband Agamemnon, and her daughter Iphigenia, from the cycles of the Trojan War and the House of Atreus. Knowing as we do the work of Neves, there will be, I think, an immediate recognition of the packed, claustrophobic-inducing arrangement of just four truncated figures with which David articulates his story. The crowned face of Clytemnestra will trigger a further flash of recognition, its model being the same as the one that provided Neves with his Veronica and his Virgin. Two mothers, Clytemnestra and Mary, cradling their adult children. The ancient Greek princess about to face sacrifice for the interests of others. The biblical redeemer already past that point. The Greek commander sacrificing his father to appease Apollo, the god who had becalmed the fleet, is rarely adduced as an analog to the divine sacrifice of Christ. In contrast to the Old Testament story of Yahweh commanding that Abraham sacrifice his beloved son Isaac. But the parallel is nonetheless patent, and David affects the correspondence between saintly imagination of Christ's martyrdom and Clytemnestra's foreseeing, her eyes brimming with tears, her daughter's terrible death, the crime for which she will eventually murder her husband, then suffer murderous retribution in turn. Every figure here is doomed. A mood that overlays the pupil's Christian preoccupations with an overriding theme of David's own. When the painting appeared as part of a public charity exhibition in Brussels, David wrote to the burgomaster to express his own gratitude for the warmth with which his philanthropy was being received. "These works," David wrote, "are the fruit of the tranquility of mind that I share with the fortunate inhabitants of this empire. What is more, to tell the truth, I never pick up a brush without blessing the wise sovereign who has procured them for me." That sovereign would be, in a literal sense, King William I of the United Kingdom of the Netherlands. Here's one more portrait of that sovereign by David's pupil, Joseph Palenque. "The realm, a cobbled together principality, hastily declared a kingdom in response to Napoleon's short-lived resurgence in 1815. In the Dutch tradition of tolerance, William protected the exiled French in his domain and thus merited David's ceremonial expression of praise. But that straightforward reading might be complicated by the lines that come after. He says, "Without pretending to learning, permit me to proclaim with Virgil, O Melibius, it is a God who has wrought for us this peace," P-E-A-C-E. And he rendered this in the Latin, "O Melibue Deus nobis haec otia fecit." Now, David had more than enough learning to know that it wasn't Virgil the man who uttered these words, but rather it was one of his characters in the Eclogues, the first of his published poems, the quotation being from Eclogue 1. "The shepherd Melibius, invoked by David, has fled the confiscation of his property, driving his starved flock ahead of him. His partner in the poem's dialogue, the shepherd named Tityrus, pronounces his grateful satisfaction in untroubled possession of a rural retreat and pastoral livelihood. But Melibius can foresee no such peaceful future." You see their names here at the head of the poem in the late Roman manuscript in the Vatican Library. Virgil's first eclogue stands as one of the most profound reflections in the Western canon upon the condition of exile in the wake of warfare and political revolution, especially as it bears on the making of art, exemplified in the piping of Tityrus's reed flute. David must have been meditating on the lofty hills around the shepherd's abode since his own premature flight to the Swiss Alps in 1815 that we looked at in a previous talk. But what exactly has the sacrifice of Iphigenia to do with such themes? And why the dominance of Achilles, suspended in the action of drawing his sword? Well, I think the beginning of an answer lies in the most proximate dramatic poetry, made vivid to the artist by his theater-going habits. Now, it had long been a device of tragic dramatists taking up this theme to expand the role of Achilles. Euripides, for example, in order to assemble all his characters on the bleak shore of Aulis, has Agamemnon summon his wife Clytemnestra with their daughter from Mycenae on the pretext that Achilles has asked for Iphigenia's hand in marriage, about which Achilles knows nothing. But when he finds out, his honor dictates that he declare an obligation to save the maiden from death, once he learns of the true purpose of Agamemnon's deception. In Jean Racine's French homage to Euripides, Iphigenie of 1674, Achilles attempts to thwart the sacrifice, declaring to Agamemnon, "I know not Paris, Helen, Troy. I want your daughter, and I leave but at that price." In fact, Racine builds on the wedding motif from Euripides to erect a full-blown love triangle with another potential victim vying for the love that Achilles has already sworn to Iphigenia. Thus, the hero's speech is vowing to save his bride, and his accompanying verbal attacks on the vainglory of Agamemnon are considerably sharpened and expanded over their counterparts in Euripides. The commander of the Greeks, for his part, coolly facing down the tirades of Achilles, replies, in Racine's version, "I want less valor, more obedience. Flee. I do not fear your ineffectual wrath, and break all bonds attaching me to you." To which the inflamed Achilles retorts, "Then thank the only bond that holds me back. I still respect the father of this child. Perhaps but for that name, the overlord of kings would never brave me so again. But one word more, listen if you have ears. I will defend your daughter and my fame. To reach the heart that you intend to pierce, this is the path your blows will have to take." Well, to relate this dialogue and this sequence of events is to locate David's anger of Achilles firmly within the world of Racine's tragedy. He describes in a letter that the tears of Clytemnestra are suspended by the hope that Achilles' threatening gesture has aroused in her. But if you were to ask exactly where does David's painting correspond to the scenario of the tragedy, the answer would have to be both everywhere and nowhere in particular. At its core must be the confrontation between Achilles and Agamemnon, but there is no such action described in the play, least of all the drawing of a sword, a gesture of overt violence that would have violated the decorum of the tragic stage. Nor are the two women present as the deep animosity peaks between the Greek's commander and his fiercest warrior. Well, these departures from the decorum of tragedy and the coherence of inherited narratives link the anger of Achilles to the freely experimental drawings of its author. Such liberties would have had a sanction not only in David's own drawing practice, but in Racine's own process as a playwright. The preface to his Iphigenie contains a long apology for all of his departures from Euripides. Departures he intended to accommodate the sensibilities of a modern audience, as he put it. Along with a description of his mix and match approach to his various and sometimes contradictory sources. And David would assume no less scope for himself. But he preserves the thing that most distinguishes Racine's version of the story from all the others. That is the deep motivation in love and pride for the eventual violence of Achilles' intervention. The anger of Achilles, as a phrase, sends one's mind well past the antiquity of Euripides to the founding moment in Western poetry, the opening lines of Homer's Iliad. Sing, O goddess, the anger of Achilles, son of Peleus, that brought countless ills upon the Achaeans. Many a brave soul did it send hurrying down to Hades, and many a hero did it yield a prey to dogs and vultures. For so were the counsels of Zeus fulfilled from the day on which the son of Atreus, king of men, and the great Achilles first fell out with one another. And every action in the epic follows from this one. The cause of the quarrel was Agamemnon being forced by yet another divine curse to yield up a female captive, and in her place he demands as substitute Briseis, the captive claimed by Achilles. In response, Achilles does indeed draw his sword, as imagined here in the engraving by the English artist John Flaxman, part of an enormously influential Homeric suite very well known to David. Only the physical intervention of Athena, who you see there at the right, who fears the ruin of the Greek cause, can stay the blow. David thus imported the theme of the hero's rage from the opening verses of the Iliad, along with the torsion in the reach for the sword that had come to serve as the emblem for that rage in past art, a move entirely in keeping with his recombinant approach to the motifs in his contemporaneous drawings. How then did David make the transition from the caprice on paper to the scale of painting? The size of this canvas, about 3.5 by 5 feet, was not the monumental dimensions on which he had been used to working in the past. But there's a strong sense in which David has not abandoned his former monumentality because his actors are just as big as they always were, that is, life-sized. It is just that we're not allowed to see them at full length. He had, in fact, recently written to a student who was at work on a half-length figural piece, saying, quote, "It is exceedingly difficult to put together a group of cropped figures without having drawn beforehand the entire figure in its movement," end quote. So the effort becomes one of preserving what he called the general movement of the entire monumentalized character in this modest format. Meaning is carried in the logic of the whole, quite apart from emphatic individual gestures like Agamemnon's decisive downward pointing at the center, lowest point of the composition. The network of bonds in which Achilles is enmeshed manifests itself as a linked highway of flesh, beginning in the face and elongated neck of Clytemnestra and following an unbroken sequence of skin-to-skin transitions until it comes to a halt in the medallion that clasps the garment of Agamemnon, the gold medallion of his authority. But the staying of the blow, absent Athena, still must be generated from within the figure of Achilles, which is the likely motivation for the pronounced twisting of the waist and neck, the sheer inflation of the torso, alongside the highly particularized emphasis on the hovering fingers over the hilt of the sword at the furthest left. There's indeed a sense in all of David's theatrical caprices that he is moving to render the lineaments of dramatic conflict in terms of figural diagrams that simply leave the constraints of any kind of temporal sequence behind, a kind of post-narrative history painting. So it's no wonder that the result has looked so awkward and so unmotivated to generations of dismissive observers, observers with narrative in their bones. What they haven't been able to see is the tremendous compression in the picture's presentation of its theme, the whole of which partakes of the invisible binding forces bearing down on Achilles. That quality that we've seen initially emerging in the Lamentation and St. Veronica of Navez. This device from the start signified to them both themes of isolation, of loss, and withdrawal. All of that preceding but underlying the literary allusions that I've just been rehearsing for you. All of the tirades of Achilles protest loudly at his absence from home, the grief of his father, his undefended lands, his displacement from his true position in the world and from his responsibilities by the self-interested vanity and arbitrary will of his master. He thus feels himself a heroic version of the dispossessed fugitive shepherd in Virgil's poem. And there is unmistakably, in the broad color scheme of the picture, an emblazoned reminder of home. When the Revolutionary Convention, early in 1794, decreed the tricolore as the flag of the French Republic, it was David who recommended that the blue always appear at the left, which is just where he puts it in three broad patches of blue, white, and red that render the resolve of Achilles to resist a barbarous decree in the patriotically republican colors of a French patriot. Now, at this juncture, as you might expect, David was not the only artist reckoning with displacement and loss, nor were such undertakings a prerogative of advanced age. Two young artists, Navez for one, and Géricault, devoted the years 1818 and 1819 to themes of outcasts and marooned survivors. For both, the emotional and social pathos of their subjects acquired extra urgency and symbolic weight from changes in the actual climate of Europe. Strange weather beyond the capacity of contemporary science to comprehend, and so inevitably lent grim significance, as if the earth itself shared the distress of humanity under the convulsions of the Restoration. For Navez, as he worked in Rome to complete his monumental canvas of Hagar and Ishmael in the desert, the heat of inspiration, he felt, was accompanied by, in his words, quote, "the excessive heat we have endured for 2 months, not a drop of rain for 4.5 months." The broken jug in the lower right of his painting signals the degree to which the Old Testament story of the Egyptian concubine and her child cast out of Abraham's camp seemed eerily congruent with the parched heavens of southern Italy. When Géricault, for his part, again found his confidence as a painter on a large scale, Northern Europe was only just emerging from 2 entire years of incessant excessive rain and cold temperatures, bringing floods, pestilence, crop failures, famine, food riots, and uprooted populations. Again, no one knew the cause, though we do now. Is it any wonder that the artist, determined on a series of immense landscapes, would have imagined them like this? A bleak, drowned world under milky light, its boatmen dragging a shadowy vessel like the bark of Charon, seeking headway over the river Styx. In the last lecture, both of these remarkable paintings will come under more extended scrutiny. As they do, the question naturally arises, how was art to emerge, if it could, from such despairing cul-de-sacs? Well, 2 artists in particular will emerge with answers. Ingres, not much seen here since the very first lecture, will be one, will offer his version of a redemptive path. The other, of an opposite kind, will come from Géricault himself. I will leave it there in a state of suspension until we convene again next week.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.